So this is the last evening. Tomorrow is the closing ceremony. And so you contemplate all that begins, ends. I always like to contemplate what I call contemplation, the beginning of a retreat. You're looking, you have those 2 weeks ahead, and now with it, what is it? It's nearly finished. The 2 weeks have passed, and that feeling of ending and then separating. So we came together 2 weeks ago, and tomorrow separates. And this sense of contemplating this, the flow of life in this way, coming together means that we'll separate. And that's how the birth, because of birth, then we'll die. So beginning always has an ending. And the conditioned realm is impermanent, like this. So you can contemplate this. The beginning of something always has this sense of a future, you know, something that will happen. Now it's past, isn't it? The retreat is now, most of it is a memory of the past and the sense of ending is like this. It's different, in a different mental state than the perception of beginning. Noticing these things, you could keep contemplating the way it is, so that you have insight. If you keep doing it, you know, like say it's like with meditation, it's like a rat chewing through a wall. You just keep chewing till you get through. They've got to kind of keep at it, and not not in a compulsive way, but just keep going. They're like going forth. They talk about bapacha, when somebody goes forth, then it's like the sense of going forth, and you keep going, you don't look back. And then there's stories about people looking back, and then they, like the Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, the woman looks back and turns into a pillar of salt. And so there's a lot of pillars of salt around. Which means, probably what that means, I'm not quite sure, but it just sounds like you get stuck and can't move on. So you keep, you know, longing for the past or looking back, but the sense of going on, going forth, and just keep going. Now this is an attitude, isn't it? Because there's a lot of difficulties in this path. It's full of pitfalls, of obstructions, of challenges, and you just keep going. I remember reading Hermann Hesse's novel years ago called Journey to the East, and always impressed me, this novel, because, you know, it starts out the H.H., Hermann Hesse calls his hero H.H., so I don't know if he's referring to himself, but H.H., you know, is going on this journey to the East, and it's full of inspiration. And he's really enthusiastic, you know, and his company. It's kind of a timeless journey because, you know, it's in the present, but yet he's accompanied by such great people as Goethe and Beethoven, people like this. And you've got, you know, he brings in all these kind of people of the past, famous people of the past. It has this timeless sense of being surrounded by the very best. You know, the kind of inspired lot of geniuses and really interesting, fascinating type people, and they're all dedicated to this journey. And then, of early stages are this build on this enthusiasm and inspiration. And then as the journey proceeds, you know, they have these interesting experiences and keeps getting kind of more kind of interesting, and people are still very enthusiastic. And then they go through this place called the Valley of, what is it, Morbidio Inferiore. And you know what's going to happen there. And they have this servant called Leo, who's kind of a faithful servant that does all the, he's the dog's body of the group. You know, he's not like Beethoven or Goethe or anything. He's just the kind of, you know, the bloke that just cleans up the messes and arranges the tickets on the train and makes sure that the tea is hot. And anyway, then they kind of praise Leo. He's a very faithful, you know, kind of patronizing way that you look down on somebody of lower class, and a good servant, a good man, you know, gets the tea on time and dedicated, you can count on him. And then in the Valley of Morbidio Inferiore, you know, suddenly they start, everybody gets suspicious. People start leaving the journey and they get disillusioned, they go away. And then H.H. starts getting very suspicious of this servant, you know. You can see things that, you know, aren't quite right about Leo. And so finally H.H. realizes, you know, this, he's wasting his time going on this journey. So he leaves it. And he goes back home and gets a job and does things. And 20, 30 years later, you know, his life isn't really amounted to anything, and he's you know, old now, and he keeps romantically thinking, you know, I'd like to, you know, what I really want to do the rest of my life is write the history of this journey to the East that ended, you know, the journey that I was on and that ended, but it was, you know, quite interesting, and if I could get the records, I would like to write the history. So anyway, sitting in the public park, and suddenly sees Leo, you know, walking the dog in the park, and he goes up and he says, "Do you remember me?" And Leo looks at H.H. and doesn't quite. He says, "You know, I'm H.H. and we were together on the journey to the East." And then Leo remembers him, and H.H. says, "Whatever happened, you know?" Because when the journey ended, and I'd like to be the historian and write a book about the journey. Do you know where I could find out more about the, you know, if there are any records or any information available?" So Leo says, "Well, I'll take you to the kind of headquarters." And he says, "You mean the journey's still in operation?" He says, "Yeah, it never stops." He says, "Just because you quit doesn't mean the So then Leo takes him to the Journey to the East headquarters, and there, you know, he suddenly realized Leo is the kind of the head man, you know, the quiet voice behind the glamour and all the scenes, and realizes that the conceit, you know, of the human mind, you know, thinking that the journey had ended because he became disillusioned. And so this is, you know, one sees this in one's own practice and in just the life of the Sangha here in England. You know, they get enthusiastic, inspired, and then those drop out, disillusioned, suspect the servant Leo and all the rest. And but the journey is you know, it's an eternal one. It's not something dependent on individuals or a particular group. So this is like keep going, you know, the valleys of Morbidio Inferiore are are the times where you really have to, you know, develop strength. And when you're really, when things are falling apart and the inspiration's gone, then it takes something else, doesn't it? It takes a kind of determination and patience and various virtues that you can't develop when everything's going well and you're inspired and enthusiastic. And with meditation, you know, that these periods, dry periods, plateaus, kind of deserts and valleys of morbidity and inferiority are, you know, can be seen also as mental states, and that this also is the journey, you know, to keep with the way it is, even when the way it is not very nice. In integrating practice into daily life, that's another challenge, because we associate our insights with a particular method of meditation or a style, a lifestyle of some sort, and so we can think that because you can't be a monk or a nun and you have to leave the retreat, then somehow the meditation stops, or it isn't as good. You know, if you go home and you can't really meditate as well as you did here on this retreat. But the ongoing, the going forth, and the kind of continuous reflection, if that's what you're feeling, observe that as a mental state. You know, about how you're choosing, you think one place is better than another and you can meditate better here than there, and just keep trusting in your ability to just be aware of the way you tend to, what you create into your mind, and then the emotions say, but you can, you know, really get concentrated and peaceful, Amravati, but when I go back to London it all falls apart. But falling apart is also meditation. See? So it's not, you know, you prefer tranquility, kind of collectedness, calm, peace. Falling apart is, you know, you don't want that. But if that's what's happening, then be mindful of that rather than frightened or disillusioned, or making it into more of a problem than just the experience as it is in the present. This takes, a determination to adhitana, to one of the paramitas is called adhitana paramita, translated as determined. And so, like, to make a determination isn't based on a kind of I'm going to do it no matter what, but it's an intention that helps you, that it can reminds you when you lose the enthusiasm or you feel you've lost the way or you feel everything is falling apart, is the intention to keep using what's happening for the path. Like we're talking about the guiding star, you're going in that direction, but you've got to be aware of what's in front of you. So that you're not, you know, as you're looking up at the star, you walk off the cliff. You've got to be with the, you know, the terrain that you're in, which isn't going to be inspiring like the star is, but it's where if this is what you're, you know, where you, what's present, what's happening, then this is, you keep going, and you'll find through wisdom, through your intelligence, ability to get through these various obstructions or difficult patches. And it does take a strong determination because, you know, sometimes we just feel like giving up or just stopping here, or we see some other path that looks more attractive. So I like to think of, I've thought of the Sangha vehicle, or the Buddha Dhamma Sangha is like a train, you know, you kind of get on it, on the train, and then it's going along the countryside, and you look out the window and you see something, oh, I'd like to go over there, but you're on the train, so you can't very well get off. You keep going till you get to the destination. But on the train you will find, you know, looking out the windows, you'll see, you know, very interesting other options and possibilities. But you're in a vehicle that keeps going, so you just keep going. Don't get off the train. As the ex-Tanavaro once said, just before he disrobed. I notice when monks, when they're about ready to disrobe, oftentimes they come and say, I want to take lifetime vows. I remember when I was years ago, and I was in university in the early years, and I was brought up as a Christian. So in the first year of university, kind of was my mother said, if you go to that university, you know, it's very worldly, and you'll lose your faith. Because the United States, the universities, state universities are not religious. You can't teach religion. So my mother was worried about it. She wanted me to go to a Christian university, which I wouldn't do. I wouldn't go to. And she was right. I lost my faith. So then... I got kind of panicked because I thought, I better. So I decided then, after I kind of realized it was all going away, I decided I'd ask the bishop to become a kind of postulant for the priesthood. So I went to the bishop in Seattle, and he said, I'd been studying in this Far Eastern Institute at the University of Washington. He was very fascinated by Chinese culture, and so I was quite interested. I had a lot of enthusiasm for this program. But then the bishop said, well, I don't think that's very useful, you know, if you're going to become a priest. So I suggest you change your major subject to something else. I changed it to history, and then I became a Sunday school teacher at the church, and I tried desperately to get back this faith, but I hated teaching Sunday school, and eventually everything collapsed, and my life fell apart, and I went into the military. So that decided determined to become a priest was a kind of like, you know, lifetime vow, and just before it all collapses. And then in Buddhism, the faith arose when I was in the military. So actually when I was in the time in the U.S. Navy, I feel quite grateful to it, because it was certainly a time where I discovered Buddhism. Because I didn't discover it when I was studying Chinese at the university. And I did discover it in the Navy. And so this was, you feel it, you know, I felt a strong kind of powerful trust, something so strong when I was about 21 years old that I've never really had any desire to do anything else. After that, Buddhism was the only thing I really could ever sustain any interest in. So that's just my experience. But being a Buddhist, and like being a Buddhist monk, I've never really had any desire to disrobe either. But a lot of times, so I've never felt desire to leave the monastic life, but I felt desire to get away from certain places that I'm in. because sometimes you find you all kinds of difficulties in situations with people or places and occasions, but then the way of using these difficulties, how to turn an obstacle into path knowledge. This takes wisdom. And how to use what seemingly a hopeless situation for meditation, because sometimes you do feel, when things aren't going well and you feel it's hopeless, or you feel yourself hopeless, or that this obstruction's so big, maybe you can't do it, you can't get over it in this lifetime. Or, you can feel totally despairing. Totally despairing, and when you're in despair, of course, it all seems hopeless. But then, what is hopelessness like? To really feel everything's utterly hopeless. So you turn, you pay attention to what you're feeling rather than just going along with it, believing it. So you keep using this, mindfulness is really turning the light, putting the light on the present. If the present you're feeling total despair and hopelessness, then you look at that. That's if that's what you're feeling now. It's still on the path, isn't it? You're still going in the right direction. This is just what happens to be in your way. So it's not like you've gone off the path. It's just how whether you really see this and see how to get past this particular difficult bit. And of course that takes this determination. And you have to use wisdom, sati, mindfulness wisdom, to be able to, get through certain things, certain puzzling situations, certain mazes and things that occur, seeming like dead ends or cul-de-sacs and all this kind of thing, or in the bottom of a pit, or in the valley of morbidio inferiore. And then you have peak moments. You get on mountaintops and beautiful sunsets and inspired moments, fascinating friends, you meet famous people, you meet, inspired, enlightened masters, and all that. But then also you've got to be mindful of that, not get just dazzled by the heights and the glamour and the fame and the beauty of it all. Because this mindfulness is seeing things as they are, the impermanent nature of conditioned phenomena of experience. So we can get high and inspired, we can just get so you know, this is absolutely wonderful, this Buddhist monastic life, it's just absolutely wonderful, you know, I love it. I'm going to devote the rest of my life. And Lungpa Cha, when you get like that, Lungpa Cha say, be careful. Rawang. They kind of bring you down too when you're getting, you know, climbing the heights of inspiration. Because it's the middle way, which is in terms of our experience here and now. And with that awareness. And it's not, and that awareness that where things are seen for what they are. So all conditions, you know, whether it's negative or positive, they all have the same characteristics of impermanence, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Even the inspiration, attachment to inspiration is suffering. Because inspiration isn't something that has any, you know, it reaches a peak, then it goes down. I mean, it has, you know, it's very nice, and it kind of maybe is the catalyst that gets you going. But as a vehicle, it won't survive if that's what you're depending on. And I was in graduate school. I met this woman, fellow student, and she'd been married 6 times. And so I said, "We're married married six times and divorced 6 times. You think you'd have learned after the first two?" She says, "I just love that romantic feeling." And when that goes, then, you know, I want to have it again. Because you can't have it with the same person. You've got to find somebody new. It's like having, you know, trying to just hang on to to kind of youthful inspiration. So that you just keep trying, you know, you have to end up kind of repeating the same things. And it doesn't work after a while, does it? You know, it's just, you can't, you know, it doesn't, just by trying to always have that kind of romantic experience, after a while, there's no way it's going to happen. Become a cynic. So, and the same with inspiration, if that's what you're depending on, after a while, it won't work anymore. Sometimes people will go around from one religion to another, like in California, for example, they call it spiritual supermarket, because you've got, you know, millions of varieties there all in front of you. Monday night, it's the yoga group. Tuesday night, it's the codependent group. Wednesday night, it's the Vipassana. Thursday night, it's the Zen. Friday night, it's the Sufi. So you can always have, you know, you can kind of keep, you know, going from one interesting thing to another. But then that, you know, that just wears you out because you never really develop anything. So it's a matter of this determination, and it's through going through the difficulties that you really, you know, you mature, you gain confidence, you develop patience. And you're developing, cultivating the way. You keep going onward. So no matter what's happening, at least I can be aware of how I'm feeling. So it, like bringing attention to your heart or to your gut, just what you're feeling, you know, without, you know, trying to stop just making judgments or thinking because you know, that there's something wrong with you for feeling the way you're feeling. But whatever way you're feeling, this is, you know, just by acknowledging it and accepting it for what it is and reflecting on it. It's like this. So despair feels like this. Disappointment is like this. Grief is like this. And so you keep learning from these experiences and these states, rather than seeing them as the things that obstruct your journey and that prevent you from getting what you want. This realm, this human realm, is like this, isn't it? It is something very. It's very irritating and frustrating anyway, even if you're not on a spiritual journey. And so this is this realm that we're experiencing now. Just contemplate it in terms, not as a personal, putting it in personal terms, but it is, you know, the experience of unsatisfactoriness, of dukkha. So that you're, because things are always changing, and every time, even when everything's going right, it changes. You can't, whatever you're attached to, you lose eventually. And so this sense realm is a realm of continuous flux and movement. So this awareness puts us in that position of attention to the changingness of experience. See, it's different than if we're looking at the quality of the experience, whether it's good or bad, pleasant or painful. Then of course we have preferences. We want the pleasure and the goodness and the best of this realm, and we don't want the other. But in terms of the path, the life for all of us is going to be mixtures of different combinations, mixtures of pleasure and pain, and good and bad, success and failure. So we're watching this emphasis on anicca or impermanence. Is what it means is really learning to look at the flow of experience, seeing it in whatever the quality might be. It's impermanent. It's flowing. It's changing. It's movement. Begins and ends. Then so I found this helpful, this emphasis on anicca that the Buddha made, because I get so the impact of the quality of experience is so strong. You know, the impact of beauty or ugliness or praise or blame is very strong. So, you know, kind of, you know, shocks you or dazzles you or inspires you or upsets you, whatever. On the conditioned level, so you always feel, you know, emotionally, one is it can go up and down all the time with the qualities that one is experiencing. But in the middle way is the way of mindfulness, where the emphasis is on the encouragement, say, in vipassana, is seeing rupang anicchang, vedana anicca, is that all the forms are impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, mental formations are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent. The Bay Sankarani Cha, all conditions are impermanent. And this isn't just to be believed in, but it's pointing to a way of contemplating, noticing the way it is. The reflection on time that I often give, I find, by using that a lot, you know, what is the past right now in terms of experience? Because experience is always now. You know, you can only experience now. The future hasn't happened yet. It's the unknown. The past, you can remember the past, so you have a memory, but it's a memory is always now, arising, ceasing in the present. So this helps you to break down your conditioned views and beliefs and attachments to the worldly perceptions of time as being reality. And that's very important, because time is something that we're firmly convinced is reality. And the society operates on that assumption, time is real. But in terms of experience, here and now, what is it? There's only the now, isn't it? There's consciousness, awareness, now. And so the past, yesterday, what is it now? Oh, I can remember yesterday, things that happened yesterday. Tomorrow is the end of the retreat. And then, so tomorrow we'll meet 5:30, same as ever. And then we'll have breakfast, then we'll do the chanting, the sprinkling, and all that. Then that'll be the end, tomorrow. So future, you know, tomorrow we know it's going to end tomorrow. But we don't really know, is it? We assume it's going to end tomorrow, because it hasn't ended yet. So in the present moment, tomorrow, the end of the retreat, is still, the unknown. We can assume, assumption is a function of the mind in the present. Speculate, and kind of, we can feel quite certain it's definitely going to end tomorrow, but that certainty is a mental state we're creating in the present. So you keep noticing this, rather than committing yourself to time as reality. Then, as you do this, you begin to realize the timeless, the eternal present, the here and now. To apprehend the point of intersection of the timeless with time is the occupation of the saint. T.S. Eliot. Apprehend the point of intersection between the timeless and time. That's I always loved that image, because that's the way it is. This right now, isn't it? It's the point of intersection, the here and now, the consciousness that I'm experiencing now, the physical body, which is time condition, isn't it? It was born, it'll die, it will die. It was born. Right now, this is the way it is. It's sitting here, like this. So it's the kind of the point of intersection. This is a time condition. The timeless, then. The point of intersection, to apprehend the point of intersection of the timeless with time is what we do when we're being mindful. Because then it is the gate to the deathless, that point in the present in which we begin to understand things as they are, where wisdom arises, where we break through the illusions of our cultural conditioning, the illusions of our personality, our self-views, all these are then seen in terms of conditions of rising ceasing, rather than assuming that this is that the, my memories and my body and my history and my emotions are kind of permanently me. That's what the personality view does, isn't it? See, you know, I'm permanently me. You know, because I was born, I've always been me from the time I was born up to the present, and I will be me till I die. And, you know, I'm this person. But in terms of direct experience, what is it? Is there a person? Or what is that? You know, then you begin to look and observe and realize the personality view is conditioned. A lot of my personality is based on, you know, on assumptions, on distortions, on misinformation, on ignorance. I was glad to know that, actually, because I used to wonder, you know, where was I when the really good personalities were being passed out? Am I one of those kind of eight balls that, you know, when God's passing out the goodies, you're standing behind the door, you're in the loo, you miss out on it. That's how I used to feel, disadvantaged in some way. I was relieved to find out that everybody has that problem. Nobody thinks their personality is the best. You know, nobody's got a personality that they feel is totally adequate and they're completely and satisfied with and happy about. You know? That personality is conditioned out of ignorance, a belief in a kind of permanent person. On attitudes based in a cultural context that come out of avijja, ignorance of Dhamma, not out of understanding Dhamma. So to realize the personality, you know, is a changing thing. For me, it was a relief. Then the question, well, what am I then if I'm not Ajahn Sumedho and I'm not a person and not a... Ajahn Chah says, you're not even a male, not even a man, I'm not a male, not a female, not a woman. I'm an American. No, not even that. So all these things fall apart. Then what am I? Buddhist? Even that one falls away. So then you realize, that in mindfulness and wisdom, you don't need to know who you are, you're just aware of what you're not. That's what anatta means, you know. You're not the body, you're not the feelings, the perceptions, the mental formation, consciousness. You're not the objects of your senses. You're not, this is not mine, or... You know, I'm not a memory. Memories are not what I am. Emotions are not what I am, even though emotions say they are you. But they're always changing, and they're very ephemeral, uncertain, unstable things to kind of hold as being really what you are is your emotions, isn't it? They go up and down and all over the place. But that which is aware, isn't it, is that awareness, that point of intersection of the timeless with time, that you can trust. So that in the refuge, see, that is the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. Then in terms of contemplating the present, like we've been doing on this retreat, this, the the body. You're not just saying the body's not self and dismissing it. That's not investigating experiences. That you just, the Buddha said, body's not self. Body's not self. I believe it. Dismiss it. That's not it. You don't go around believing Buddha's teachings, but you investigate. So you examine. You know what this physical body, and you're looking at it like we've been doing with an intuitive awareness, not through some kind of analysis, but through awareness of it as experience in the present. And I remember, you know, the convention is that your mind is in your head, isn't it, in the West. Your mind is up here, your brain. In Asia, and they where's your mind? They point to their hearts. And in Europe, they say, it's up here. Because we're very much identified with brains. Yeah, that's the highest achievement, isn't it? They call it, I remember in America, you know, you call somebody who is very intelligent, they're a real brain. That was even a compliment at one time. She's got a really good brain. Bad heart, but a good brain. And then when you get into more heartfelt things, you're like the sweetheart. And you don't say sweet brain, do you? My sweetheart, and you're talking about feeling. But my cultural perception was the mind was my brain. And then living in Asia, then I began to, my mind is my heart. And then when one still perceived that the mind was somehow inside the body. But when you really recognize intuition, then you realize the body is in the mind, isn't it? Because when you are contemplating the body in the present, it's in the mind. Not the body's not contemplating anything, isn't it? So there's this sense of the mind contemplating the body, so that you feel after a while the body is the mind is the thing that is here, out here, and that this body is in the mind rather than in the brain, or the mind isn't the brain. So then this sense of a mind being pervading, or, you know, like it's not something that isn't just some kind of function, neurological function, but something that is universal, eternal. It gets more like that, you think, more, you know, unlimited, rather than just the nerves in the brain. Then I find that this body becomes more like, for me now, the body is more like a radio or something. It's like a receptive instrument, picks up things. So there's birth, and then it's like we're all kind of conscious beings in the unit, conscious entities, and we're receptors. The universe around us impinges. We feel, the things that contact this form. So that it's more like a radio, rather than a person, a kind of permanent soul or person. And then we all have our own karmas, so how we interpret experience varies. You know, cultural differences, and the way women tend to interpret life and men interpret life, or Asian or European, or different generations, or old people or young people, ethnic conditioning. But when you get into awareness, that awareness, that pure awareness, isn't conditioned by culture or ethnic conditioning. It is pure. It has no quality that is conditioned by any culture. And so it's transcending these differences that we identify with, as it being male or female, or being European or Asian. Then, so wisdom, satipanya, bring us to a pure state of awareness where the conditioning process can be, we can have perspective on it. Whatever it is, it's impermanent and it's not self. It's anicca, it's dukkha, anatta. Not many people know this because the identities are very, you know, real for most people. They fight over them. They'll die for some kind of political identity or some ideal or some kind of ethnic identity. It's the way Northern Ireland is such a difficult place because people are so attached to their identity as being Ulster Unionists or Irish Catholics or whatever. These aren't ultimately real. These are conditioned. I mean, you're not born as an Irish Catholic. After you're born, then your mother tells you you are an Irish Catholic. That's conditioned, isn't it? Cultural condition. So the way one sees the world around changes through meditation, because one is investigating. We're not just operating from cultural biases or even religious biases, like Buddhism. Is pointing, you know, we're not trying to become Buddhists, you know, with Buddhist ideas and identifying ourselves as we're Buddhists, as being the kind of where we're coming from. Buddhist teachings are pointing to experience here and now, to investigate experience, so that we're not just, trying to just change our costume and change uniforms and just become Buddhists. It's like changing your clothes, isn't it? If you're just adopting Buddhist ideas and Buddhist identity. But, I mean, that, you know, that's fine too if that's all you want to do. But if you really understand or have some intuitive appreciation for Buddhist teaching, then it's much more profound than just the identities with the institutions and the conventions that we call Buddhist, because it's taking us to awareness, to enlightenment, to seeing clearly the truth of the way it is. The Dhamma, the truth of the way it is. And then how many of us find that frustrating? Because we want truth defined. Okay, what way is it? People write, enormous volumes of philosophy speculating about the nature of truth and reality. So it can go on and on and on because it gets increasingly complicated. Trying to read Heidegger and people like that. And just so, I mean, it's kind of brilliant in its own way, but in the end, And what happens? And you don't really, you know, you don't really know after you finish the book. So maybe you might know more about Heidegger. But the meditation then is where you are knowing the way it is. It's direct knowing. It's wisdom. It's not knowing about Buddhism, but it's knowing Dhamma, the truth of the way it is. And the Buddha gave these ways of, you know, kind of his own brilliant approach was that all conditions are impermanent. All Dhamma is not self. There is the conditioned, there is the unconditioned. Atti bhikkhave ajatang aputang akatang asankatang. There are bhikkhus, there is bhikkhus, the unborn, uncreated, unoriginated, uncompounded. So the Buddha's making this statement, there is, and that's quite a wonderful thing, isn't it? Because, and the way he puts it isn't in terms of anthropomorphic or mythological terminology. It's quite scientific in a way. Uncreated, unborn, ajatang, and then uncreated, unoriginated, uncompounded. So, but that, this negation of conditions, isn't it? Because the born, the created, the originated, the compounded are conditioned phenomena. The body's born, it's created, it's compounded. Feelings, the Vedana is that way. And perception of sanya, sankhara, these are all about the born, the created, the originated, the compounded. But the Buddha's pointing to the unborn and uncreated. So in terms of our experience, you know, because we're so identified, so stuck into a belief system around the born, the created, as being me, mine, reality, and so forth, that vipassana is the means the Buddha used to investigate, to break down this illusion. Because when you really look, you know, when you really contemplate experience, you can't find anything that has any real permanent quality, no real essence or substance that has any lasting quality. The body seems to be, you know, it has more kind of substance, seemingly permanent substance, than say feeling does or perception, but it's always changing too. So I mean, you know, people like become very materialistic because, you know, if you buy gold or something, you know, it seems a little more permanent than other things. Isn't it? Gold is, it's metal and valuable. So it gives you a sense of, you know, maybe just my refuge will be in gold. But that's pathetic, isn't it? That isn't a very good refuge, is it? And also, and people steal it, and it. It's hard to carry it around, and you gotta spend a lot of time putting it in vaults, and you pay rent on the vaults, and these kind of. And then, you know, people rob banks and systems are corrupt and they cheat you, and it's just endless headache. You know, property, isn't it? Owning property is a pain. You know, it's really awful to be a property owner. So this is, even though property seems like a good investment, kind of solid, but in terms of investigating, you realize that the ephemeral ness of the conditioned realm. So in the unconditioned, the unborn, uncompounded now, and this is the point of intersection of the timeless with time, where it's the point between the conditioned and the unconditioned, and that with awareness, then there, as you see the cessation in your mind, this is a mental experience, because this is what we can work with in the present, the mental conditions that have arisen and ceased in the mind. And then the cessation, the third noble truth, the Nirodha Satya, then you realize that the deathless, the unconditioned. Because then more and more you're aware of the deathless reality, the realization of Nibbana. Now, there is the unborn. Ati bhikkhave ajatang aputang akatang asankatang. There is. Then the Buddha says, and because there is the unborn, uncreated, unoriginated, uncompounded, there is escape from the born, the originated, the created, the originated, the compounded. There is an escape from it. So, I mean, this is, if there was no unborn, uncreated, unoriginated, uncompounded, there would be no escape from this realm of death. And that you just go through it over and over again. Just this so tedious process, birth and death and ignorance and feeling, without any escape at all. It's like an eternal cycle of that goes on and on, tediously repeating the same things over and over again. But because there is the unborn, uncreated, unoriginated, uncompounded, there is escape. So this is where the mindfulness is the gate. Is the path to the deathless, and that's here and now. This attentiveness, this awareness, and trusting yourself to pay attention to life, you will realize there is this realization of the deathless, the unborn, uncompounded. So in this investigation, in this search, in this journey to the east, you keep going till you realize it. It will become very clear. So even doubt and despair, everything that you'll feel about this, you know, what are they talking about? Even that, doubt is... Shine the light on that. That's a mental state. Doubting, not understanding, that's another mental state. Aversion, that's another mental state. Restlessness is another. And keep lighting up these mental conditions until you no longer believe in them. You see them in terms of their changiness, their flux, their movement. And then they cease, and there's the ringing silence. there's a sense of the of eternity or deathlessness, no self. It's realized. It's not, you don't acquire it. Not that you get it, you realize it. You wake up. And that word realization I like a lot because it's reality. So reality is now, it's not something you're going to get next year. It's just a matter of waking up, of paying attention, and breaking down the momentum of habits that you've acquired. Not getting rid of them or suppressing, but breaking down the illusion, the grasping that we have around them, the commitment, the belief to ignorance and the illusions of self, of personality, of the distorted perceptions we might have, or the prejudices and all this that might rise up in us, that we're breaking through these illusions through awareness, through wisdom and awareness. So this doesn't just have to do with a retreat here at Amaravati, but in your daily life, keep trying to contemplate what's happening. This, even if you don't have a lot of time for formal practice, it's always good to take time to see meditation, sitting meditation or walking meditation. But see it not as a, don't make it into a compulsive thing you have to do. Because most people's lives, we get very compulsive, and then we do it because we feel we have to, and we feel guilty. Then if we don't do it, then we feel guilty. If we don't practice, and then we feel burdened and so forth, and then we give up. But that's the thing, that you're looking at the process, the thing that you're experiencing, rather than holding to a view that you've got to practice so many times a day and do this and that and then kind of get caught up into that, and then when you can't do it, then you feel guilty, guilt-ridden, or you give up. All those are mental states that you can keep shining the light on. And encourage, to have some discipline in your life into sitting practice and anapanasati and so forth. These are very good things to develop. But see them in terms of something more like relaxation. Like, see anapanasati not as something you've got to do, but as a time to rest and just, let go of the world and all the stressful activities, just to be with the breath, with the body, the silence. See it as like a pleasant rest. Lingpo Tso used to call it holiday for the heart. But if you start conceiving meditation as a duty, then after a while you won't want to do it because you've got too many other things to do. And meditation is the easy one to put off, isn't it? When all the world saying, worldly things are the important, this is the real world. It's very intimidating, so I don't have time today to sit. If we start conceiving meditation as some, in a worldly way, then it's one of the things that easily gets forgotten or laid aside. So don't put it in a worldly context, but see it as like eating food or like something you really love to do. Make it, so it's something that you relax with, that you feel, that isn't just another activity that you have to fit into your busy schedule. And then also, if you do, you know, if you do make it into something you've got to do, really notice that, see that kind of sense of compulsive, making something very compulsive. You've got to do this, or become obsessed with this or that. Shine the light on these kind of mental habits so that you start seeing them and recognizing they're like this, rather than indulging them or resisting them. So even your bad habits, your worldly habits, they're all part of the path. You know, nothing is wasted. Your good thoughts, your bad thoughts, it's all developing the path when you're seeing it with mindfulness wisdom. So that nothing that you think or feel that is an obstruction, unless you want to regard it as such and believe in it as that. So that's enough for this evening, and tomorrow we can finish off the retreat.